Today I want to talk about the causal structure of black holes. That's going to be the sort of main topic of the lecture. So the idea behind this is some of you, or maybe all of you, are already familiar with the notion of a Penrose diagram. And it's just a tool that we often use in general relativity to try and encode causal structure of different space-times. So what we'll do is we'll see how to construct the Penrose diagram. So you've already seen Kruskal coordinates, so we'll kind of use those to build up this causal cartoon, if you like, of the black hole space-time. And we'll do that using our Schwarzschild solution, which we derived yesterday. So just as a recap, we had written down a metric with spherical symmetry that was static, and we derived the Riemann tensor of this metric and showed that the Einstein equations told us that the radial function, if we chose this area gauge, the radial function depended on a sort of local mass density. And if I looked at the time and radial components, I saw that if I combine those two equations, and have a feeling there might be a b squared over here. I haven't written it down in my recap here, but something doesn't look quite right there. If I add the radial and time Einstein equations, then I get something that tells me about a sort of difference between B and 1 over A. So the Schwarzschild solution was that A squared was 1 over B squared was 1 minus 2gm on R. And we associated M with the mass of the black hole. So you've probably looked at this solution quite a lot in the introductory relativity course. So just while we're on the recap, I just want to look at what happens if we add a cosmological constant. So again, I expect you saw this in the initial relativity course. The cosmological constant was something that Einstein originally added to his field equations because it could be there, and there was no reason not to include a general term that might be present and was consistent with the symmetries of the theory with the equivalence principle and everything else that he was trying to build up in his theory of general relativity. In addition, as he thought, the cosmological constant allowed him to have static cosmological solutions, which, of course, as from a modern perspective, is a bit of a joke, because we now imagine our cosmological constant, we call it dark energy, and observations tell us that indeed there is dark energy or something very close to a cosmological constant in our current universe. So what happens if we add a lambda? Well, if we add a lambda, these two pieces will cancel. So it tells us that A is still 1 over B. And then here, if T naught naught is just a constant, I can integrate that up really easily. So we have, if I input 8 pi g T naught naught equals lambda, I find that I still have my integration constant m, which still gets identified as the mass of a black hole, but I now have to integrate this up, and I find the effect of my cosmological constant is to add a term proportional to r squared in B, and therefore also in A. I can always rescale my time to have this thing still being one unity. So let's just have a quick summary of what this does. If lambda is positive, then this is known as de Sitter, a de Sitter universe. So this would be approximately the universe that we're currently living in. So we see that if lambda is positive, then both of these terms here are negative. So in fact, I have that a squared goes to zero at roughly r is 2gm, plus a little bit. But also, at r is roughly root 3 on lambda, minus a little bit. So obviously, these are not exact expressions, because this is a cubic equation, but it means that you can write down an algebraic relation for your two zeros. And if the mass is small compared to 1 over root lambda, then the roots are roughly 2gm and roughly root 3 on lambda. So they're close to that. So although we'll be talking in a bit more detail, you've already seen what happens in the Schwarzschild spacetime, and you know that when GTT goes to zero, this signals a coordinate singularity in your spacetime, and you see by manipulating the coordinate system that this is just simply a horizon. It tells you that it's a boundary in spacetime between events that an asymptotic observer can see and those that they can't see. So typically, if you see a zero in GTT, you associate that with a horizon. So here, this would be the event horizon of the black hole. And this other one now, it's called a cosmological horizon. Because in de Sitter space, the space is expanding so rapidly that any individual observer sees that there's a boundary between events in the universe that they can monitor and those that they can't. So presumably, this was I think you did de Sitter space in, do you know, Anna? Or okay. Well, hopefully you heard about the cosmological horizon, about the fact that de Sitter space has horizons for individual observers, and this is what is showing up in this coordinate system as a zero. So I'm just going to remark that de Sitter actually has quite several coordinatizations. So what we've just seen, if I set pure de Sitter, so I'm going to set m to 0 here, and I'm going to set lambda to 3, because I'm not really interested in so this would be what I've just written down with m equals 0. So this is known as the static patch. For the fairly obvious reason that the metric is not time dependent. But there is another patch, so you can change coordinates such that the sitter looks like, a bit like, a sphere, except a Lorentzian sphere, so a hyperboloid. This is the global patch, or coordinates, really. And they're global because they cover the whole of De Sitter space. So there's no region of De Sitter space that's left out. The static patch, on the other hand, as r goes to 1, there's a coordinate singularity. And going back to our intuition from black holes, you know, that, or you suspect, that this is just a coordinate singularity. You know how to explore that. You do a Kruskal type of procedure and extend beyond r equals 1. So this does not cover the whole of De Sitter space. You can see it because there's problems at r equals 1. And then there's another patch. In which, again, you can choose a different set of coordinates. And here, this space here is just r cubed. So all of these are exactly the same space, just sliced differently. This is the only one that covers the whole of De Sitter. This one here is important because it's used in cosmology. So in cosmology, you typically write your space-time as having a cosmological time plus a scale factor times some sort of homogeneous isotropic three-dimensional Euclidean space. And we usually write that as a flat space because we believe our universe is flat. So therefore here, this is just r cubed, and we have an exponential scale factor. So this one's typically, I mean, this would be the standard exponential inflation. Inflation isn't quite exponential, but it's a good approximation. So what happens if lambda is less than zero? So this is probably something that is less familiar. Well, this is called anti-De Sitter space. And we see that our metric I'm just going to write k squared as minus lambda on 3. It's to emphasize the fact that this last term is now positive. So once again, we're back to the situation where there's only one horizon. And it's roughly, it's close to 2gm. So black holes in anti-De Sitter space are used rather a lot in applications of string theory because, of course, anti-De Sitter is half of the gauge gravity correspondence. So you probably heard of ADS-CFT. The only thing I want to comment on is that this one here in this equation came from the fact that we were dealing with a two-sphere here. So when I was deriving the curvature, I commented that you had this internal surface of symmetry, the two-sphere. The two-sphere has curvature, and that this kind of came along for the ride as in, and it showed up throughout our calculation of the Riemann tensor. And so it was embedded in there, inside our Riemann curvature. And here we see that if instead I changed my d omega squared to some general two-dimensional space, so kappa equaled 1 would be the 2-sphere, kappa equals 0 would be r squared, kappa equals minus 1 would be h squared, the negatively curved two-dimensional space, then this 1 becomes a kappa. So if you're in either lambda greater than 0, de Sitter, or in flat space, you have to have kappa equals 1, otherwise your a squared, your GTT, would be negative, and that's not consistent with the Lorentzian signature. However, because this term is positive, in anti-de Sitter space, we can have kappa is 1, 0, or minus 1. So what that means is, in ADS, we have spherical, planar, and hyperbolic black holes. So that's something that's distinct. So something that we often say in four dimensions is black holes have to be, or event horizons have to be spherical. Well, as a caveat along with that, it's only true in vacuum or positive cosmological constant. So now let's go back to Schwarzschild and start thinking about causal structure. So you saw when talking about the event horizon, r equals 2gm, you saw how to construct Kruskal coordinates, which make explicitly 2gm regular. So they're new coordinates, which extend beyond the event horizon. So you define them by first redefining your radial coordinate. So you simply take the integral of dr over gtt. And so the idea here is that when you go back to look at the tr part of the metric, it becomes just a single factor times dt squared minus dr star squared. And so what that's telling you is propagation of massless particles will occur along curves t equals plus or minus r star. So that's the first step. You go to a set of coordinates in which your characteristics are just straight lines. It doesn't do that much for you. It's still a singular coordinate system, but it's now beginning to hint at how you go move beyond the coordinate system, because you imagine, well, my prefactor's going to zero at a particular surface in the radial coordinate, which is now r star, but you've actually pushed that off as r goes to 2gm, off to minus infinity. And so by taking exponentials of these functions that are running off to infinity, you can move that horizon to some finite point and at the same time hopefully re-express this prefactor in a form which now looks regular. So you have So what we've done here is we've first of all taken this tortoise coordinate. I then said null rays have t as plus or minus r star. We're thinking about causal structure of the black hole space-time, so this gives us a clue or intuition that thinking about the null rays, t as plus or minus r star, is the right sort of thing to do, the right set of coordinates to manipulate. And so all you're doing is exponentiating these null coordinates, t minus r star and t plus r star, which run off to infinity at the event horizon, 2gm. And by doing so, you're bringing that 2gm to some finite location in capital U and capital V space. And it turns out, by looking at it explicitly, you also deal with that prefactor. So if I look at du dv, so du depends on dt minus dr star, dv depends on dt plus dr star. One over that squared. So that's what my du dv looks like. However, if I then look at what uv is, I see that the dependence on the time coordinate factors out, and all I'm left with is something which is a function of my radial coordinate. But now if I look at r star, you see that if I exponentiate r star, I get a factor of r minus 2gm. So this function uv goes to zero as I tend to 2gm, and you can see that it goes to zero in the same way as that prefactor. And so I have written up to some multiplication constants as I tend to 2gm, I've written this initial Schwarzschild metric, in which the metric was singular at 2gm, simply as some function du dv. So my ds squared My notes are written in a different notation, and I've gone and I'm trying to do it over. So I'm now writing my function r implicitly as a function of uv. You can see that since uv depends only on the radial tortoise coordinate, clearly r is a function of uv, but it's not expressible in a simple analytic form, because to invert that, obviously, you've got to invert this r star. But you can see that in principle, at least, you can do that. So implicitly, r is a function of uv. And now, if I look, as I tend to 2GM, this factor goes to 1. This factor is just a constant, and so there's nothing wrong with my metric. So these are the Kruskal coordinates. So now let's try and identify where our horizon is and what our space-time looks like in the new coordinates. If I'm at constant radius, then uv has to be constant. Similarly, if I want to look at constant time, then what I have to do is to divide u by v. So what happens at 2GM? Well, at 2GM, my r star becomes negatively infinite. So if I look at v, it looks as if my v is going to 0. Or I guess if r star becomes negatively infinite, my uv becomes 0. Now, if I want to ask what's the image of r equals 0 in these coordinates, though strictly speaking, I've gone beyond where I should in my Schwarzschild coordinates, nonetheless, if I take r equals 0, put in r equals 0, and ignore the business with the log, then again, modulo the fact that you have to consider about the branch, about what branch of r star you're on. Essentially, that's going to r star equals 0. So uv is 2gm squared at r equals 0. So let's try and sort of extract as a picture what this means. So first of all, u and v were null coordinates. So that means I want to draw them at 45 degrees. On the blackboard, because C is 1. So this is my U and V system. And if I go back and think about the interpretation, my V is associated with the coordinates T plus R star. So I can see I want my V to be increasing as I move out in. So I'm thinking of my R as being sort of this type of direction. My t roughly as being up the board. So if r is 2gm, uv equals 0. So this tells me either u is 0 or v is 0. So here's one line, v is 0. And then U is negative my physical space. So this is my U coordinate. And then R is constant. So this is my horizon here. Actually, let's do it red. Blue's a silly color to use. So if UV is a constant, then that looks something like this. Then T is constant, is U is proportional to V. And that's a T equals constant line. So our Schwarzschild solution here, this is the region that it covers. This is our external space-time, external to the black hole. R equals zero was UV is plus 2gm squared, so it's another hyperbola. Should be symmetric, but... So that's what our space-time looks like, maximally extended. Once we hit R equals zero, we're stuck because R equals zero is a real singularity. And you can see that by looking at invariants formed of the Riemann tensor, because those invariants blow up. So you've got infinite tidal forces at R equals zero. So we say that's a real physical singularity at the center of the black hole. So although that encodes the causal structure of the black hole, it's still something that is non-compact. The U and V coordinates run between minus infinity and plus infinity. What the Penrose diagram does is it shrinks this into a simple single cartoon, which sort of is compact and just fits on a little piece of paper. So how do we do that? What we do is we define some new coordinates. We want to shrink the infinite range of our UV plane onto a finite range, so we simply take the inverse tangent. That will take us from infinite, minus infinity, infinity, down to minus pi on 2 to pi on 2. So V equals 0 corresponds to P equals 0. And similarly for Q, if V is 2gm, then P is pi on 4, and so on. So if I now use an expression for the multiple angle or multiple tangent of P plus Q, then you can see that I've now got an expression here where UV goes to 2gm squared, which is the singularity. So I can now identify what does this coordinate transformation do to my plane. Well, I've still got null lines being identified as my P and Q. But now the whole range has shrunk 2 minus pi on 2 to pi on 2. So the singularity is now p plus q. Here is plus or minus pi on 2. So here goes as a straight line. So this is q equals pi on 2. P is pi on 2. This line is q equals 0, so that's r is 2gm. Similarly, that line. And now I ask, what happens as we go off to infinity? Well, as we go off to, as v goes to infinity, that says p is pi by 2. So that's just this line here. And as u goes off to infinity, tells me q is pi on 2. So this is what my shrunken space-time looks like. So here we've got p is pi on 2, so that's capital V going to infinity. Q is minus pi on 2. U goes to minus infinity. Now, obviously, the metric then changes, and you have, you know, sort of prefactors that become infinite as you move out towards the edge of this diagram, naturally. But the key feature is that if you just want to sketch what's going on, this picture represents the causal diagram of your Schwarzschild space-time. So it identifies the horizon as a null surface, which we know it is, because it's a boundary between what we can see and what we can't see. And therefore, something exactly on the boundary, you can imagine a photon that's always exactly at 2gm, always trying to go out but being pulled back in by gravity at the same rate that it's trying to escape. So this is, if you like, something generated by a light ray moving radially outwards of the black hole. And because we have a time symmetry, we also get a corresponding surface under time reflection. So this was coined, the black hole, by John Wheeler. And this piece, this surface, is sometimes called a white hole. And in the maximally extended Schwarzschild space-time, you get both this positive and negative feature of the black hole. So it's just Penrose. Sometimes they're called Penrose-Carter diagrams because Brandon Carter was also involved in their development. Let me just also look at Minkowski space. We started with the black hole because that's what we were talking about, and the process of identifying the causal structure is more interesting, but we can now sort of step back and say, what do we do if we have just simply flat space? So with flat space, I don't need to jump through all these hoops worrying about regularity of the coordinate system, and I can simply define my u and v as t minus r and t plus r, which are now completely regular coordinates. And again, I can say, well, if r is positive, which of course it is as a radial coordinate, then that tells me v minus u is bigger than zero. So I can do the same sort of thing, except there's no 2gm here. I'm just going to define p as the arctan of v and q as the arctan of u. So here in my uv system, I throw away that side, that half of the plane. And then taking my transformation to P and Q, it shrinks down, remember, this infinite range to just minus pi on 2 to pi on 2, but I'm not getting that half at all. So what I get in the PQ system is this. I simply get a triangle. So this is my P, and this is Q. And so this is the causal structure of Minkowski spacetime. So this is R equals zero. It's not a boundary. It's simply just the zero of a radial coordinate. So a light ray coming in would just bounce off R equals zero because it basically has gone through the origin, comes out at the polar opposite angles, but at increasing R. So we've suppressed the S2 when we write this diagram down. So each of these points and these lines, however, is a boundary, and they all have names or labels. Which I'll just quickly write down. So I plus, if you look at it in Minkowski space, every time-like observer ends up there. Because the only way you can get to that null surface at future infinity is by coming in along a 45 degree or something that asymptotes a 45 degree angle. So any time-like observer has to end up at I plus, and we call it future time-like infinity. And similarly, any time-like observer has to have come from past time-like infinity. The point I zero, I say it's a point, but we've suppressed the S2. I zero, the only way of getting there is by approaching it along a line which is at more than 45 degrees to the vertical. So that means a space-like line. So I zero is space-like infinity. Because you can only get there along a space-like geodesic or curve. The other two, this I is a curly I, it's meant to be a script I. We call it scry. Scry plus, if you look at the surface, the only way you can get there is going along some null curve or something that's asymptotically null and to the future. So that's future null infinity. And similarly, scry minus is past null infinity. So these are the terms that we use to describe infinity. And so in our Schwarzschild diagram, we still have a scry plus and a scry minus, because you can see, if you look over to the right-hand side, it looks the same or very similar. Well, it does look the same as Minkowski. That doesn't mean it's exactly the same because you've got two different metrics. So the details are different, but causally, as you move out to infinity, you've got something like Minkowski space-time. And the reason for that is this metric is asymptotically flat. At large R, we kill that term, and we've just got Minkowski space-time in spherical coordinates. On the other hand, as we move over to the left, we see a very different structure. This R equals zero has now been pulled and stretched outwards. And instead of R equals zero, we've got this additional null surface, which is the event horizon, future and past. So in Schwarzschild, still got a scry plus and an I plus, but we now have two horizons. And our singularity at r equals zero has become space-like. So what about these other black holes that I was talking about? Schwarzschild de Sitter and Schwarzschild anti de Sitter. Well, this is where things start getting more complicated. So for the de Sitter, well, in both cases, if you go to small r, you get something that looks very like your Schwarzschild black hole. So you expect this bit to look the same. So this is, if you like, small r black hole. But now if I move to larger r in de Sitter, I hit another horizon. Whenever I have a horizon is a null surface, which means I've got lines at 45 degrees in a Penrose diagram. So this is my black hole event horizon, and I now have a cosmological horizon. So this here is where cosmological time tends to infinity. And then what happens if I maximally extend, I end up producing other copies, and so on and so on. So what you have to do in terms of my static Schwarzschild de Sitter solution, you have to do a Kruskal extension over these horizons, and you cannot simultaneously extend across all four future and past event horizons. So you can extend across simultaneously your black hole horizon, future and past, but then that coordinate system breaks down over here. You can also extend simultaneously across both future horizons, but not across the past ones. So you can't construct a global coordinate system for Schwarzschild de Sitter in the same way that you can for the Schwarzschild space-time. I'm not sure how readable that is. Yep.
Will the global patch identify all of those black holes?
The global patch of de Sitter. Yeah. The global patch of de Sitter is just for pure de Sitter space-time.
Right.
So it's, yeah. So when I wrote down, where are they? There. The different familiar, sort of usual coordinate systems that you see de Sitter in, I'd set m to zero. So you could take the coordinate transformation, which takes you from the first to the second up there, and you could try applying that to Schwarzschild de Sitter instead of just pure static patch de Sitter. What you end up with is something that now has a sort of mixed terms, dt, dr terms, and what your sort of event horizon, r equals 2gm, then kind of is not, in the coordinates, it doesn't mean that the area changes, but in those coordinates, it's now not a simple curve. So you can't sort of find this nice global system. There's always some wrinkle. So the idea of the Penrose diagram is you want to extend beyond coordinate singularities, so you want to go beyond these event horizons. And the static patch is a natural way, patch in which to identify the event horizons. You could use pseudo-global coordinates, but then your black hole event horizon would become quite messy. So, and you would end up having to unravel and go to a Kruskal type of coordinate, which would then introduce problems elsewhere. So it seems like you can't sort of have this nice, sort of really neat global picture as you do with Schwarzschild, but then actually Schwarzschild is very special because it's really sort of the only, almost the only type of system where you do get something so straightforward, except for in Schwarzschild ADS, again, you draw the black hole part. But now what happens in ADS is almost the reverse of DS. You've taken null infinity and you've actually brought it in to a time-like infinity. So this now is a boundary. And this is the singularity. So this is what the causal structure of a Schwarzschild ADS black hole looks like. So Anna, can you just remind me, are they going to do Riesner-Nordström in the tutorial? So you'll also be looking at Riesner-Nordström this afternoon, which is a charged black hole, and you find that so maybe you can see whether this is what you will. You find in a charged black hole, your singularity becomes time-like rather than space-like, and you end up with two event horizons, or what look like two event horizons, and this becomes the causal structure of a charged black hole in Einstein gravity. So you'll be seeing more of that this afternoon. So I'd just like to wrap up by asking a question. I've had a few questions earlier on in the week about Euclidean manifolds and what happened, for example, what happens to the Cartan formalism if you went through and you changed signature? And the answer is not a lot happens. Everything has the similar shape, but maybe there's the odd minus sign sort of coming in here and there. And you end up with a curvature that at least in form looks very similar, although occasionally there might be a change of sign. So that naturally begs the question, if we just, I say Euclidean black hole, really the notion of a black hole depends on a notion of observing and therefore depends on a notion of causality, which we do not have in a Euclidean manifold. But it's nonetheless quite interesting to ask the question, what happens if we take the Schwarzschild solution and make it Euclidean? So once we have a solution to Einstein's equations, to the vacuum Einstein's equations, they give us a solution to a Euclidean manifold with zero Ricci curvature. So just as the Schwarzschild solution is a physical vacuum solution, if I take the Schwarzschild metric and Euclideanize it, I also get a Ricci flat solution. So this is my Euclidean Schwarzschild. So let's ask, what happens as R goes to 2gm? Now, if I was just looking at this as an abstract manifold and I didn't know anything about black holes, I might say, well, okay, but it just looks singular. Maybe this is just a singular manifold. However, we have this intuition that what we've written down in a Lorentzian metric is not singular at 2 GM. It's simply an event horizon. So can we therefore examine, does this mean that we can find a Euclidean in this Euclidean metric? Can we somehow find a way to make it non-singular at 2 GM? So let's look a bit more closely, because our intuition from the black hole suggests that there should be a way of making it non-singular. So if I just ignore this, which is simply going to give me just a two-sphere of fixed radius, what I'm trying to look at is what happens to this time or TR part of my metric. So if I focus on the radial coordinate on which everything depends, I can actually make this apparently singular coordinate regular by, instead of taking r, taking the square root of r minus 2 gm. That'll get rid of the irregularity as r goes to 2 gm. So let me define a new coordinate by saying that it's proportional to the square root of r minus 2 gm. Then 2 rho d rho is going to be lambda dr. And my new metric on the TR section, well, r minus 2 gm is just rho squared on lambda. And if I look at over here, r or lambda r is just rho squared plus 2 gm lambda. So the bottom line is just rho squared plus 2 gm lambda. So that's my T piece. And then my R piece, well, it's the inverse of that. So rho squared plus 2 gm lambda over rho squared. And then dr squared is just 4 rho squared d rho squared divided by lambda squared. So now I can say, right, well, let me look at rho goes to zero, because that's what I'm trying to explore. What happens as r tends to 2 gm? Well, that's just equal to rho squared over 2 gm lambda dt squared. Those rho squared there cancel. And then I've got 8 gm on lambda times d rho squared. So if I choose lambda to be 8 gm, then that just gives me d rho squared. And then I define a new coordinate theta, which is t over 4 gm, my two-dimensional TR space looks like d theta squared, rho squared d theta squared plus d rho squared. And that is just the origin, near the origin of the plane, expressed in plane polar coordinates. Provided theta has periodicity 2 pi. So I can make 2 gm regular in this Euclidean metric, provided I have say something very specific about a periodicity. So theta here is related to T. So it's telling me the periodicity of my Euclidean time has to be related to M. So this means I can make a regular Euclidean metric which corresponds to a Euclideanization of my Schwarzschild black hole at the price of introducing a periodic Euclidean time. But then that becomes quite interesting because if I look now periodic Euclidean time in field theory corresponds to a finite temperature. So the temperature goes like 1 over the periodicity of Euclidean time. So that would be beta, which is 1 over 8 pi gm. If I put my, yeah, that's right, reinstituted my constants that I'd all set to one. So this is not how, so this is saying that if I do this very bizarre process, it actually has some meaning and it corresponds to saying that the black hole looks as if it's at a finite temperature. Now, it's a bit cheeky because typically you're imagining some sort of equilibrium field theory here. And if the black hole's mass is inversely proportional to the temperature, you see it kind of tends to evaporate faster and faster. So it's not really conducive to thermal equilibrium. But nonetheless, this is, of course, very fascinating because we know that black holes do indeed evaporate. And that had been shown previously by Stephen Hawking. By considering quantum field theory on a Schwarzschild-type background. So this very formal, bizarre, apparently, thing to do gives something that's consistent with an awfully more complicated calculation. And so when you need to calculate the temperature of a black hole, in practice, this is what you do because it's very quick and it's very easy. So you never worry about the caveats. You just Euclideanize and make the horizon regular. So although it's something that really has no right to work, Gary Gibbons and Stephen Hawking showed later on in the 70s that this sort of Euclidean approach, and I'll probably say more about the Euclidean approach to gravity later on in the course, actually seems to give a lot of very sensible answers. So again, I think Anna has plans for you to do this afternoon for the Reissner-Nordström black hole. So there you go. First week and we've already done Hawking radiation. Right.